greetings everyone, and thank you so much for coming for today's event. My name is Andriy Smitsnyuk. I'm a lecturer in Ukrainian at the Slavonic Department at the University of Cambridge. And it is my great honor today to present today's speaker, Ms. Oleksandra Matvichuk. Ms. Oleksandra Matvichuk came to prominence by leading the Euromaidan SOS, an initiative that was providing legal support to all the victims of the corrupt Ukrainian president's Yanukovych government. And she is currently leading the Center for Civil Liberties, a Ukrainian organization that has been monitoring human rights violations since 2014, and also monitor war crimes since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. I am also very much honored to present to you Oleksandra, because Oleksandra and her team are the very first Ukrainian citizens to ever win a Nobel Prize. They won Nobel Peace Prize in 2022 for monitor war crimes and asking one very simple question: how to bring justice to Ukraine. And I think this is a very important question today, because February marks at least 2 years since Russian full-scale invasion, and the year 2024 marks 10 years of the beginning of annexation of Crimea and beginning of the actual war. I also would like to introduce you Professor Mark Weller, a chair of international law and constitutional studies at the political studies and international studies department at the University of Cambridge, and a senior UN mediator. I also want to say that this event for you was brought in collaboration between Cambridge Ukrainian Studies, Cambridge Union, and Center for Geopolitics. So I would like to thank Center for Geopolitics, specifically Professor Brendan Sims and Dr. Lisa Wickers for providing support and co-organizing this event, as well as Nick Davis from Cambridge Union and all the members of Cambridge Union, and Cambridge University Ukrainian Society for spreading information about this event. It will take a form of a lecture that will take 30 minutes. Then you would hear the moderation of Professor Mark Weller and questions on international law. And also then it will be followed by a 30-minute Q&A session. With this being said, thank you so much for coming today, and I hope you enjoy today's talk. And please join me in welcoming Ms. Oleksandra Matvichuk to Cambridge Union.
It's a huge honor for me to address to this distinguished audience. I'm a human rights lawyer, which means that I have been applying the law to defend people and human dignity for many years. But now I'm in a situation when the law doesn't work. Russian troops are shelling residential buildings, schools, churches, museums, and hospitals. They are taking evacuation corridors. They torturing people in filtration camps. They ban Ukrainian language and culture. They forcibly deporting Ukrainian children to Russia. They are abducting, robbing, raping, and killing civilians in the occupied territories. And the entire UN architecture of international organizations and treaties can't stop this. Since the beginning of the large-scale war, we face with unprecedented numbers of war crimes. We united our efforts with dozens of regional organizations. We built national network of documentators throughout the country, including the occupied territories. And we have an ambitious goal to document each criminal episode which was committed in the smallest settlements in each oblast in Ukraine. And working together, we have already recorded and contributed over 62,000 episodes of war crime to our database. And 62,000 episodes, it's a huge amount, but it's just a tip of iceberg, because Russia uses war crimes as the methods of warfare. Russia tries to break people resistance and occupy Ukraine by the tool which I call the immense pain of civilian population. So to be clear, we document not just violations of Geneva and Hague conventions. We document human pain, like in this story of Ilya Matviyenko, a 10-year-old boy from Mariupol. When Russians surrounded the city, they didn't allow the International Committee of Red Cross to open the green corridor and to evacuate civilians. Hence, Ilya and his mother hid in the basement of their house from the Russian shelling. Like many people in the city, they melted snow to have water and made fires to cook at least some food. Once the supplies ran out, they are forced to go out, and consequently, they became exposed to shelling. His mother was wounded in her head, and the boy's leg was torn. With the last of her strength, his mother dragged her son to a friend's apartment. And there was no medical assistance, because prior to this, Russians destroyed the maternity hospital and the entire medical infrastructure in Mariupol. And that is why in the apartment, they lay down on the couch and just hugged each other. They were lying like this for several hours. Ilya told to my colleague that his mother died and froze right in his arms. So I have one question. How we people who live in 21st century will defend a human beings, their lives, their freedom, and their dignity? Can we rely on the law, or does just brutal force matter? The answer to these questions is important to know not just for people in Ukraine, Sudan, Syria, China, or Nicaragua. The answer to this question will define our common future. I don't know how historians in future will call this historical period, but we happen to live in rather turbulent times. The world order, based on the UN Charter and international law, is collapsing before our eyes. The international peace and security system established after the Second World War provided unjustified indulgences for certain countries. It didn't cope well with global challenges before, but now it is stalling and reproducing the ritualistic movements. The work of Security Council is paralyzed. We have entered the period of turbulence, and now fires will occur more and more often in different parts of the globe because the international wiring is fault and sparks everywhere. Samuel Huntington predicted that the new global conflicts would arise between different civilizations. I live in Kyiv, and my native city, like thousands of other Ukrainian cities, are constantly being shelled not just by Russian rockets, but also Iranian drones. Syria votes in favor for Russia in UN General Assembly. China is helping Russia circumvent sanctions and import technologies critical to warfare. North Korea sent Russia more than 1 million artillery shells. we are dealing with the formation of entire authoritarian bloc. However, Russia, Iran, China, Syria, and North Korea are different civilizations according to the Huntington classifications. However, they have posed a crucial common feature. All these regimes that have taken power in their countries have the same idea of what a human being is. Therefore, there is not a conflict between different civilizations. This is a conflict between different anthropologies. Authoritarian leaders consider people as objects of control and deny them rights and freedom. Democracies consider people, their rights and freedoms, to be of the highest value. And there is no way to negotiate this. The existence of the free world always threatens dictatorships with the loss of power, because human beings inherently have a desire for freedom. Therefore, when we speak about Russia's war against Ukraine, we speak not just about the war between two states. This is a war between two systems, authoritarianism and democracy. And this becomes more obvious when we consider its causes, because this war started not in February 2022, but in February 2014. And this was a time just after the Revolution of Dignity had ended in Ukraine. Millions of people had bravely stood up against corrupt and authoritarian government. They took to the streets across the country. They fought just for a chance to build a country where the rights of everybody are protected. Government is accountable, judiciary is independent, and police do not beat students who are peacefully demonstrating. And we pay a rather high price for this chance. More than 100 peaceful protesters were gunning down in the main square of the city. When the authoritarian regime fell, Ukraine got its chance for democratic transitions. And to stop Ukrainians' progress towards genuine democracy, Russia invaded. Russia occupied Crimea, part of Eastern regions, in 2014, and in 2022, it expanded the war into the large-scale invasion. Because Putin is not afraid of NATO. Putin is afraid of the idea of freedom. And Russia, with this war, wants not just to punish Ukrainian people for our democratic choice, which we made 10 years ago. Russia attempts to convince the entire world that freedom, democracy, rule of law, and human rights are fake values. Because they couldn't protect you during the war. Russia wants to convince that a state with a strong military potential and nuclear weapons can break international order, can dictate its rules to entire international community, and even forcibly change internationally recognized borders. And if Russia succeeds, it will encourage other authoritarian leaders in the world to do the same. The international system of peace and security can't protect people anymore. This means that democratic governments will be forced to invest their money not in education, healthcare, business development, or culture, not in solving global problems like climate change or social inequality, but in weapons. We will be witness an increase of the number of nuclear states, an emergence of robotic armies and new weapons of mass destruction. If Russia succeeds and this scenario comes true, we will find ourselves in a world which will be dangerous for everyone, without any exception. Unpunished evil grows. Russian military committed horrible crimes in Chechnya, Moldova, Georgia, Syria, Mali, Libya, other countries of the world. They have never been punished. They believe they can do whatever they wanted. I personally interviewed hundreds of people who survived Russian captivity. They told me horrible stories, how they were beaten, raped, smashed into wooden boxes, electrically shocked through their genitalia, and their fingers were cut, their nails were torn away, their nails were drilled. One woman told me how her eye was dug out with a spoon. There is no legitimate reason for doing this. There is also no military necessity. Russians have done these horrible things only because they could. And now we all witness how this war turned people into the numbers, because the scale of war crimes grows so fast that it's become impossible to recognize all the stories. But I will tell you one. This is a story of 62-year-old civilian Oleksandr Shelipov. He was killed by Russian military near his house. This tragedy received a huge media coverage only because it was a first court trial after the large-scale invasion. His wife, Katerina, shared in the court that her husband was an ordinary farmer, but he was her whole universe. And she told to the judge that she lost everything. People are not numbers. We must return people their names. We must demonstrate justice for all victims of this war, regardless who they are, their social position, the type of crime and level of cruelty they endured, and whether or not media or international organizations are interested in their case. And this is possible. Now we have a new digital instruments which provide us an opportunity to record what happened, to collect evidence, to identify perpetrators, which we can't even dream of 15 years ago. The work of Bellingcat and other investigators convincingly proved that in order to restore what happened, there is no necessity even being on the spot. People are not numbers. We must return people their names, because the life of each person matters. International humanitarian law regulates how people must kill each other in wars without providing excessive suffering. If we want to prevent wars, we have to punish states and their leaders who start such wars. Because all atrocities which we now and other colleagues in different parts of the globe document during the wars, it's results of someone's leadership decision to start the war. In the whole history of the humankind, we have only one precedent of punishment for the crime of aggression. It was Nuremberg trials. And we still look to the world through the lens of the Nuremberg trials, where Nazi war criminals were tried, but only after Nazi regime had collapsed. But we live in a new century. Justice must be independent of how and when the war will end. We cannot wait. We must establish a special tribunal on aggression now and hold Putin and top political leadership and high military command of Russian state accountable. When international community deal with wars, there is a great temptation to avoid solving difficult problems, hoping that they will just vanish. But the truth is that they only get worse. People in Ukraine want peace much more than anyone else. But peace doesn't come when country which was invaded stop fighting. That's not peace. That's occupation. And occupation is horrible. Occupation is just another form of the war. Occupation is not just about changing one state flag to another. Occupation means enforced disappearances, sexual violence, denial of your identity, forcible adoption of your own children, filtration camps, and mass graves. Russians unleashed terror on the occupied territories in order to save them under their control. They deliberately exterminated active local people there. Mayors, journalists, volunteers, religious leaders, artists. People live in gray zone. They have no possibility to defend their rights, their freedom, their lives, their property, and their beloved ones. The good illustration is a story of children writer Volodymyr Vakulenko. Children writer Volodymyr Vakulenko wrote beautiful stories for children in Ukraine, and entire generation of children brought up on his daddy's book. During the Russian occupation, Volodymyr disappeared. His family hoped to the last that he is alive, but just like thousands of other Ukrainian civilians are in Russian captivity. But when Ukrainian army released Kharkiv region, we found mass graves near Izum in the forest. And in unmarked grave under the number 319, we found a body of this dead children writer, Volodymyr Vakulenko. I know his family. It was extremely difficult for them to accept this result of identification. And you can ask me, for what Russians killed children writer? What a purpose? I have just only one answer. Because they could. And that is why there is something which is not understandable when I hear the political debates about how to solve this war. We can't left our people alone for torture and death in the occupied territories. The life of people can't be a political compromise. Calls for Ukraine to stop defending ourselves in order to satisfy Russia's imperialist appetites, it's not just wrong. Such calls are immoral. Public intellectuals say that we live in an era of post-truth. As for me, we live in an era of post-knowledge. People with access to Google, who can get the formula for aspirin in a second, forget that this doesn't make them chemists. People around the world are demanding quick and simple solutions. Perhaps in more peaceful times, we could afford it. You can treat a runny nose with squats, and at least it will not harm the body. However, if we are already dealing with cancer, the price of such simple solutions and actual therapy delay will be high. And the problem is not only in that fact that in authoritarian countries, the space for freedom is shrinking to the size of the prison cell. The problem is that even in well-developed democracies, the political forces who openly put into question the Universal Declaration of Human Rights gain weight. And there is a clear reason for this. The current generations replace those who survived the Second World War. And they have inherited democracy from their parents. They have never fought for this. They start to perceive freedoms and human rights for granted. They became a consumers of democracy. And they even see a freedom like a possibility to make a choice between cheeses in supermarket. And that's why they can easily exchange their freedom for economic benefits, for illusion of safety, or for their personal comfort. But the truth is that freedom is very fragile. You can't attain human rights once and forever. We every day make our choice. And I'm sure that we must defend our values, because this is a determination to act which defines a civilization that has a future. I told from the beginning of the speech that I'm now in a situation when the law doesn't work. But I do believe that it's temporary. I have been working with the law for many years, and I know for sure that when you can't rely on the legal instruments, you can still rely on people. We get used to think in the categories of states and interstate organizations, but ordinary people have much greater impact than they can even imagine. We have our own example about it. Immediately after the invasion, the international organizations evacuated their personnel, but ordinary people remained. And it were ordinary people who helped to survive under artillery's fire. It were ordinary people who took people out from the ruined cities. It were ordinary people who rescued people trapped under the rubble of residential buildings. It were ordinary people who brought the encirclement to provide the humanitarian aid. And ordinary people started to do extraordinary things. And suddenly, it became obvious that ordinary people fighting for their freedom is stronger than even the second army in the world. I would never wish anyone to go through our experience, because to live during the large-scale war, it's a horror. But these dramatic times provide us an opportunity to express the best in us, to be courageous, to fight for freedom, to take a burden of responsibility, to make a difficult but right choices, and to help each other. Because when we help each other, when we risk the life for others whom we never met before, in this moment, we are acutely aware what does it mean to be a human. And I know that the future is unclear and unguaranteed, but I'm still looking future with optimism, because we have a chance to fight for future which we want for us and for our children. And this is so luxury to have a chance and to fight for it. In the world which is so interconnected, where the only spread of freedom make our world safer. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It is difficult, I think, to give a speech that is at the same time somber and yet inspiring. And I think you have managed to do that in an amazing way. Thank you so much on behalf of all of us. There are three elements that kind of stuck in my mind. One is we need to give dignity. We need to give the names back to the victims. They're not a number, but they're individual destinies that, through arbitrary decisions elsewhere, were suddenly destroyed, cut short, put in ruins. That would be one point I think we could pursue. The other point, which I particularly noticed, especially in the country where we are thinking about abandoning the European Convention on Human Rights or other such benefits, democracy and human rights is something we have to fight for every day, you said. And that, I think, is something which, for us who live in relative luxury and calm, is probably worth remembering with particular vigor. And then the third point to which I would like to come concerns the law. You gave us a bit of the vision of the jungle of the authoritarian states of the world who will turn any attempts to have an international rule of law into a field of ruins. And nevertheless, you're a human rights lawyer and you have stuck with it. And perhaps we can look at that. And I want to start perhaps on that point, given that our audience in large measure consists of students. What brought you to the idea that law can change, defend things, or defend people? What made you become a lawyer?
When I was a child and studying in school, I got acquaintance with Soviet dissidents. And suddenly, I found myself in a circle of fantastic people. The people who say what they think and do what they say. The people who was so brave that they stood up their voice against the whole totalitarian Soviet machine. The people who were jailed, subjected to forcible psychological treatment, some of them were killed. All their career were ruined, the families were separated, but they have a dignity to continue their fight for freedom. And they have no other instruments, only just their words and their own position. And now, in 2024, we know that it's not so little, because we return our independence in 19th after the collapse of Soviet Union only because these people stood up their voice in 60s. So, like a young girl, I was so inspired by this example that I decided to myself to study law and to fight for freedom and justice.
And your fight for freedom and justice did not just start during the Euromaidan protests and later the revolution, as it were. It started even before, when you had human rights work to do. What kind of work was that?
I started with a human rights education. And this was the first what Center for Civil Liberties, which I created in 2007, started to do. Because I strongly believe that we can't left human rights just for lawyers or diplomats. It's a task for the whole society. And if we speak about transition period, which we now experience in Ukraine, regardless of the large-scale war, we have to do our democratic reforms. It's not enough just to adopt qualities laws or build formal institutions, because values of society always prevail. They will provide energy for these laws and institutions to work in the right direction. So we start with the human rights education, and when Revolution of Dignity started, suddenly for us, we became a single window for each persecuted protesters in the country. And if I may, I will tell you the story, because I think that so many failures in the world we have with the human rights and justice, so let's share some inspiring example. Because when we created civil initiative Euromaidan SOS, we do it like this. We gather it after the several hours when police brutally beaten students in Maidan, and we start to think what we can do as a human rights lawyers to in this situation. And we decided to create a legal assistance to these persecuted students. And we opened Facebook page and made a first post. We wrote that if you were beaten, if you were arrested, if your relatives disappeared during this night, please call us and we will provide legal assistance pro bono. And this was a huge adventure, because I'm a lawyer, but I'm not attorney. and there were no attorneys in our circle. So in 30 seconds, we made the second post. If you are attorney, if you want to help people who were beaten, arrested, or disappeared during this brutal night crackdown, please call us and we will connect you. And it was a miracle, but it suddenly started to work. During the Revolution of Dignity, we united thousands and thousands of people to provide legal assistance to persecuted protesters throughout the country. We worked 24 hours a day, and every day, hundreds of people who were beaten, arrested, tortured, accused in fabricated criminal or administrative charges passed through our care. So it's a real example how indifference and involvement of legal community can make a huge change.
Yes, I guess repression requires silence. And perhaps you were one of the first organizations in the Ukraine that made use of the internet, as you just described, to mobilize, but not only to mobilize opinion, but also competence and capacity to stand up to the government. So that would be, I think, an interesting example to other cases, where you don't just organize protest, but you also organize the forces of counter-government, the law, and other mechanisms. So that is inspiring, I think. Now, on the moment that the president left in 2014, I think he took a holiday, was it, in the Russian Federation?
Let's name like this.
What did you feel at that moment when the news came through about his holiday?
Probably, I will be very honest, I felt nothing because it was the third month of protest and we sleep 3 or 4 hours a day. Like, we were exhausted, and in this time, suddenly, some identified soldiers appeared in Crimean Peninsula. And I remember that we sent a first mobile group there, and we were the first human rights organization who sent mobile groups to Crimea, to Luhansk and Donetsk regions, to document what's going there. And at that moment, we have no idea that the war has already started. But what I want to refer in this example, I would like to share with you my main lessons learned, which I think it's important not just for me and for freedom fighters, but I think for vast majority of people. Because if we return to the time of Revolution of Dignity, we also faced against the whole state machine. Because paramilitary group Tetushki cooperated with prosecutors. Prosecutors cooperated with courts. The former president, security service, government, and majority of parliament were against peaceful protests. They want to liquidate us, even physically. And in this regard, it was so easy to say, but what I can do? Like, the law doesn't work. But our volunteers and our lawyers fought very honestly for each person, for each procedure's measures. And suddenly, we start to work not just on legal, but on symbolical level. A level where ideas and senses emerge. And the main idea which we provide during the Revolution of Dignity was the following. There is no guarantees in our lives. You can be arrested, you can be beaten, you can even be killed, but there are people who will fight for you, who will never leave you alone, who will do their best to save you and take care about your family. And this understanding helps people during the Revolution of Dignity to overcome their fear and to continue the struggle. And the main lessons learned from this example, because I know that not just in Ukraine, but in different other parts of the globe, right now, people are fighting for freedom and human dignity. In the unbelievable circumstances, they faced with enormous opposing power, and sometimes, very often, their efforts may seem have no senses. But the truth is that we have to continue our fight honestly. And the result, even unexpectedly, will be achieved.
Yes. Now, if we look at the result as it seems likely or unlikely at the moment, the news are reporting that the situation is kind of stuck, that there's a military stalemate, and that the torture of the people of Ukraine seems to continue and continue, and that international support starts to waver. Is there a sense amongst the Ukrainians that you may be approaching a tipping point when doubts creep in as to whether this can be done successfully?
Probably I will allow myself to reformulate your question.
Thank you.
Because now I'm always being asked about so-called Ukrainian fatigue. And this is obvious because, unfortunately, this is not just one tragedy in the world which is going on right now. And I have to answer very honestly that people in Ukraine has no luxury to feel tired. Because if we will be tired, we will be killed. This war has a genocidal character. It's not just because Putin and top political leadership of Russia say that there is no Ukrainian people, that we are the same as Russians. There is no Ukrainian language, there is no Ukrainian culture. And then, if you know Russian language, the propagandist on TV interpreted this very clearly. Ukrainians have to be either re-educated or killed. And then we, as a human rights lawyer, document how these words resulted in concrete actions. And even if we speak about forcible deportation of children, Ukrainian children, to Russia, it's not just war crimes. From my perspective, it's a part of genocidal policy, because these children first were put in re-education camps. They were told that you are not Ukrainian children, you're now Russian children. And then they are forced to be adopted in Russian families. So I know as a lawyer that it's very difficult to prove genocide. And there are a lot of debate about it. And the term of genocide in international law is formulated more modest than the Raphael Lemkin ingrained in this term context when he invented it. But even from the common sense, if you want liquidate some national group, partially or completely, there is no necessity to kill all representatives. You can just forcibly change their identity, and the entire national group will disappear. So why I explain this? Regardless of the legal frame, there is a real life. And each people in Ukraine know that we have no other choice. If we stop fighting, they will be no more us. If we speak about Ukrainian fatigue abroad, like, we have, I think, to be very honest with define the phenomena, because how you can get fatigue in Berlin, in Geneva, in Paris, in London, from Russian war against Ukraine, because you are not under Russian bombardment, you don't provide your studies in bomb shelters. So if it will be fatigue, I think the results has to be like this. I'm worried with all the situation, so let's provide Ukraine everything which Ukraine need to win this war. But it's not like this. So my hypothesis is that it's not fatigue, it's lack of decisive action.
Yes, I think you are... I think we are all distressed by the fact that international attention seems to be only capable to cover one issue at a time, be it Syria for some time, Afghanistan for some time, Ukraine, Middle East. And as you were outlining at the beginning, the confluence of various crises is a very major challenge. But the point you're making really is, in the face of genocide, there's no giving up. And I think that is something which, for us in the comfortable places, is something we should well remember. You are saying that you are restoring the dignity of victims by recording, giving back their names, but of course you have more in mind. You want to achieve accountability. Tell us a little bit how that project came about of recording and what your plans are for moving from recording to accountability and then maybe reconciliation. Russia will always be your neighbor, even if you fully win, and somehow one has to live with one's neighbors.
It's not an easy question. I will try to answer on different aspects of this question. First, I will start with the point that I work directly with victims of this war. And that is why I know that they see justice very differently. For some people, justice means to see their perpetrators under the bars. For another people, justice means to get compensations. And without this, they will feel as unsatisfied. For some people, justice means a possibility to know truth, what happened with their beloved ones, and that's all. For another people, justice means a possibility to be heard and to get official recognition that something which happened with them and their families is not just immoral, but illegal, which means that we have to create a comprehensive justice strategy and appropriate infrastructure to satisfy all these different needs. And now we face with accountability gap, which have several dimensions. First, I mentioned in my speech, because there is no international court who can prosecute Putin and top political leadership and high military command of Russian state for the crime of aggression. And all these atrocities, which we now documenting, it's result of their leadership decision to initiate, to plan, and to start this war. Even International Criminal Court has no jurisdiction in situation of Russian's war against Ukraine. So it means that to fill this accountability gap, we have to create special tribunal on aggression and hold these persons accountable. But there is a second dimension. The activities of International Criminal Court is extremely important. But International Criminal Court will limit an investigation only to several selected cases, which means that 98% of everything which we are documenting, it will be a burden of responsibility of national legal system. And just for you to imagine, we, like in Ukraine, according to the official data of Office of General Prosecutor, have opened more than 120,000 criminal proceedings. Can you imagine the work and challenge to investigate during the large-scale war more than 100,000 cases? It's impossible for the best national legal system in the world. Ukraine is not the best national legal system in the world. So we need international assistance.
Is that coming? Do you have enough human rights groups or official organizations assisting you? And in the right way?
The international community try to help us. And like they create different consultants' bodies, they organize different trainings. But I always use this metaphor. If you have a car without petrol, you can hire the best driver in the world, like Schumacher, and the car will not move. And the problem is not that we Ukrainians don't know what has to be done. The problem is that we are lacking of working hands because we face with unprecedented amount of war crimes. And you can conduct millions of trainings. You can send hundreds of consultants. it will not help us. When Russian troops were withdrawn from Kiev region in April 2022, France sent France Gendarmerie to work in Kiev region and help Ukraine with DNI identification because they were mass grave there. And it was very important assistance, but it was temporal, just in Kiev region, and it not cover all investigation, but only part, very essential, forensic expertise, but it's not about the whole process. But when Ukrainian army released Kharkiv region in September 2022, my friend, the head of the largest online media in Ukraine, had to volunteer in a morgue. Not because he is specialist in DNA, but because there were no other working hand there.
Is there for you to articulate these needs and represent them to the diplomatic world, to governments, to organize better what they offer you, rather than what they think they have, what you know you need, as it were?
Yes, I do it constantly. Mm-hmm. And I hope that I will be heard.
Mm-hmm. Good. You mentioned genocide. Today, the International Court of Justice declined jurisdiction on the third of the three present genocide cases on most aspects, other than the question of whether Ukraine is committing genocide, which must leave you with a slightly, you probably haven't seen it yet because you have been on the road, but it must leave you with a slightly sour taste about the ability of international mechanisms to have an impact on the crisis after the first hope of the provisional ruling of that court, which told Russia to go home, which was a great success.
Let me explain what this case is about for our audience. Ukraine submit a case to International Court of Justice based on UN Convention Against Genocide. And this case was supported with dozens of countries. And the goal of this case is not to prove that Russia commit genocide in Ukraine. The goal is opposite. Ukraine asked the court to tell that Russia misused the rhetorics of genocide as a false reason to invade to Ukraine. And today, simply saying, the court tell that we can't give the answer to this question because it means that we have to judge like about going beyond the jurisdiction of UN Convention of Genocide and judge the roots for this illegal large-scale invasion. So that's happened. And the question is, okay, if it's gone beyond the frame of UN Convention of Genocide, for whom we can apply for defense? I think this is the main question.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the court did an amazing thing in an interim phase when it says, well, we will have to look at it in the longer term, but for now, in this emergency, we will order Putin to go home, to withdraw, which was a great success. And it was a very creative move the Ukrainians did to try and use international law for their benefit. The court is always reluctant to make orders which it knows will not be complied with, as it would have known this would be the case here. But the disadvantage is that now, as the court looks at the firmer legal basis of it, it almost sounds as if Ukraine lost the case. And has lost something which actually it didn't really ask for. So that is a risk that you have run and you're now facing the consequence. Where else can you go? Well, there are the various proposals to create ad hoc tribunals. The Council of Europe, various others are saying, why don't we organize with the Ukrainians or without them an international tribunal? Obviously, Russia would not participate. Its allies wouldn't participate. It would be friendly states who would conclude an agreement to have an international tribunal to judge the Russian leadership for a war of aggression, for all the horrible crimes of humanity that are being committed. I presume they will ask you quite a lot about whether that is helpful or not, given that you are the holder of the evidence. You are the authentic voice of the victims, as it were.
The problem is that the war has not just military dimensions, but other dimensions as well. Economic dimensions, informational dimensions, the dimensions of values. And in this regard, this war has already crossed the borders with other countries, because you are also inflicted with Russian propaganda, and the Russian security service also working there. But why I mention it, because when we speak about international crimes, like crime against aggression, war crimes, crimes of genocide, or crimes against humanity, like there is at least some infrastructure and some norms which regulate what has to be done and what is prohibited. But when we speak about informational war and this dimension, the regulation is not so clearly defined. And I think that this is a huge problem, because when we speak about wars, they always have this dimension to fight for hearts and minds of people. And I saw how Russian propaganda is working in other countries, because I saw how it's fabricated through the victims in which I work with. I will tell you one story. This is a story of a young woman from Donetsk. She was illegally abducted and illegally detained, and she was beaten with a metal stick. And that time she was pregnant. And she begged not to beat her because she's waiting for a child. And she got a response that, look, you have pro-Ukrainian sympathy, which means that your child has no right to be born. But then they changed their mind and told, okay, we will release you if you will tell that you are a sniper. For sure, she agreed. She can tell that she's Batman. So she told me that she learned by heart the text which they prepared. It was the first time when she got clean clothes and had a shower. And then so-called Russian journalist arrived. And the one detail like shocked me mostly, that when they arrived and looked to this girl, they have no surprise that she's pregnant. But they ask her to sit in a pose to hide her pregnancy, because it's ruined the whole plot that she's a sniper. So with such facts, Russian propaganda tried to impose their narrative. And the problem is that it's very effective, because what Russia tried to do, Russia tried to show that, not that the Russia is right, Russia tried to show that everybody is bad. And everybody is bad, what the difference? And I think how we have to tackle the problem, this problem, with the legal instruments. Because this so-called journalist, it's not about journalism. They are just a part of military machine, and they tried to achieve the military goals. And we had a precedent in the past when on the international tribunals, the leading propagandist also was presented. But our time is much more different, because the false information can spread like this in a second throughout the social networks. So I have a feeling that we are lacking of instrument how to face this challenge.
My feeling is that this case is so extraordinary and is so clear where the justice of the case lies, that these attempts are often seen as what they are. So they have not been as effective as in other cases, I think, where Russia has been involved. So I think thus far, at least, that has not affected the view. But let us now hear all of your views in the form of questions, please. Less commentary. But in terms of questions, first hand was yours. Is there a microphone rushing towards you?
Thank you so much. Excuse me for my bad English. Alexandra, I want to ask you a question, what I am, what about, I am thinking a long time and I'm trying to handle with this. When we arrive here in Great Britain, British people very support us very much. And when I started to communicate with people, I understood that almost all in this country is reading paper, is watching TV, and they are trying to understand everything. But we have some huge wall between us. Because British people, they are living in democracy country very long time. And they are living in with rights, with believing in human rights, and the people are important, and every person are important. But we were born in different country. We had occupation, we were occupied Russia. We had our government before 2014. With this government, when we can be killed and nothing. And now we know what huge evil is Russia. But we couldn't explain this our British friends, because I have friends who every time is asking me, why couldn't you to sit down with Russian president, with Russian people, and just couldn't to agree to everything, to solve this problem and to have peace. And I can understand that British people really couldn't understand that someone wants to kill you because you are different, because you are not Russian, because you are Ukrainian. But how can we explain them?
First of all, I would like to take the opportunity to express my huge gratitude to people in Great Britain for your support and for your assistance to Ukrainian people in this dramatic time of our history. We are extremely grateful. It's very important in such kind of challenge not to be alone. And we will never forget Great Britain who support us. So returning to your question, the problem is that for so long time, the Western democracies looked to our part of world through the Russian prism. Let me explain this on one example. There is some museum in United States, which is called Metropolitan Museum. And they have a picture of Degas, which is called Russian Dancers. And if you are Ukrainians or Russians, you came to this picture and you clearly understand that there are not Russian dancers because they are wearing traditional Ukrainian clothes and with these flowers, vinok, which is called on the Ukrainian language. And for lot time, the scientists, the artists, the representative of museums of Ukraine sent letters to Metropolitan Museum and to ask them, let's think about this problem. They are not Russian dancers. Why you title women in Ukrainian national clothes like Russian dancers? And they ignore it. Only after the large-scale invasion, the Metropolitan Museum changed the name of picture. Now it's called Dancers in Ukrainian Clothes. Probably they still think that they are Russians, but just wearing Ukrainian clothes. But it's a huge step on a long way to understand for Western society that everything that you know about our part of the world, it was Russian narrative. You never heard people from Belarus, from Georgia, from Yakutia, from Tatarstan. I mentioned the part of Russia itself. You know nothing. You think that you have a knowledge. And that's why you can't understand what's going on. But Russia is empire. Empire has a center, but has no border. When empire has energy, empire will always expand it. And you can't negotiate it. It's a nature of empire. And one example, when in Kherson the Russian tanks appeared, immediately after this, the banners with Russian poet Pushkin appeared there. Because such banners with Pushkin is not just like quoting of great Russian poet. It's a road sign with which Russian Empire mark their new territories.
Okay. Now we are alternating from Labour to Conservative, and the Liberals up there, maybe, if somebody is. I have from the Labour side, I have you next, and then we're looking for somebody more in the back over there, and I have you next on that side. So first you, please. Microphone switches on. Stand up, maybe.
Which ways has the Nobel Prize helped you? And in which ways has it been more of a burden or perhaps of a big spotlight that more than enabling
Frankly speaking, to be a Nobel Peace Prize laureate is an additional job. But it's also a great opportunity. Because for decades, the voice of human rights defenders from our part of the world wasn't heard. For decades, we're told that peace and human rights are inextricably linked, and country which massively violate human rights and freedoms, such country poses a threat not just for their own citizens, but to peace in the entire world. And Russia, which persecuted Russian civil society, killed journalists, jailed activists, dispersed peaceful demonstration, is provided a threat not just for neighbors. But well-developed democracies closed their eyes. They continued to do business as usual with Russia, to shake Putin's hand, to build gas pipeline, and now we are in such situation. I would like to emphasize that we shared this Nobel Peace Prize with our Russian human rights colleague and Belarus human rights colleagues. And this, not just our colleagues, it's the people with whom we work on daily basis for decades. Like some replication of tradition of Soviet dissidents movement, when people from different countries try to defend people and human dignity in situation when the law doesn't work and jointly counteract the evil which tried to dominate. And now it's happened again. So the Nobel Peace Prize provided opportunity for human rights defenders from our country to be heard. And this is a huge responsibility, because we always ask ourselves, are we doing enough to decrease the level of deaths in the battlefield, to decrease the level of deaths in the occupied territories, to decrease the level of deaths in the deep rear? And probably because there is no such question, but I think it's extremely important, I would like to emphasize that I'm extremely grateful to my brave Russian human rights colleagues. Because they face not just with the Putin's regime, they are faced against the majority public opinion who either supported the war or pose this position of non-objection to the war, like governments know better. And they are in very vulnerable position. Can you imagine that they decided who will go abroad and continue to work abroad and who will stay in Russia and preparing to go to jail? Can you imagine such ethical choice? I think that nobody has to face this such. So I'm very grateful, and I think that even the tiny minority of society voice is extremely important, because it's not solved the problems, but still they provides a hope that Russia is not just Putin. Russia is also country of Sakharov.
Now I'm looking for a student, a young person from the back on my left. Who is a student and holds the hand up? Is that a hand there? Is that a student?
Hi, my question is about, there's some people who would argue that war crimes tribunals can have a negative impact on peace negotiations, and that the Russians might be incentivized to continue onwards if they know they're going to go to prison. Do you have a response to this, and if you think this should be a concern or not?
If I understand your question properly, I will answer it with returning to the near past. In 2014, when Russia occupied Crimea and part of Lugansk and Donetsk regions, Ukraine has no chance to return it. The sanctions against Russia were very weak. The Russian authorities still were welcomed. Let's be honest. The presidents of countries of G7 call him regularly and try to perceive him to stop. And how Russia used this time? Russia transferred Crimean Peninsula, which was the beautiful resort, into a military base. Russia trained the forces, prepare the attack, and start large-scale invasion. So the problem is not that Ukrainians don't want peace. The problem is that Russia don't want to refuse from their goals. And in such situation, all thinking how to put sides on the table is just, even not hope, it's just wishful thinking. And wishful thinking can't be a strategy.
But I think the question is, does insistence on accountability make it less likely that ultimately you can achieve a peace agreement?
Thanks.
Putin is not going to sign if it means he goes to prison.
But
he's not going to sign anyway.
Now it's not depends on Ukraine, and I'm very, very grateful for International Criminal Court to issue the arrest warrant against Putin and his child commissioner Maria Lvova-Belova, because it's a huge historical step, which will have long-term and short-term perspective. In long-term, the international crimes have no statute of limitation, and we know that authoritarian regime collapse. And the leaders who seen themselves untouchable appeared under the court, like Milosevic from Serbia. In short term, it's very important because still we have politicians who want to return to business as usual with Russia. And such politicians had to be aware when they shake Putin's hand, they shake the hand with the officially recognized the biggest child kidnapper in the world. But when you go to the history to answer to your question properly, when we speak about this long-lasting tradition of impunity, let me remind you that when Nazi war criminals were tried on the Nuremberg trial, the Soviet Gulag have never been condemned or prosecuted. And this is a chain of violence and international crimes which is committed during all this period in our part of the globe. And when you look to this situation from the historical perspective, you have a clear understanding that justice is precondition to peace in our part of the world, where Russia uses a war as a tool how to achieve their geopolitical interests and uses war crimes as the methods how to win this wars.
You. There's a microphone there.
So, thank you very much for being so persistent and vocal ambassador of truth. I would
Let me explain and provide a little bit information about this case. Maxim Butkevich is a human rights defender and also a friend of mine. In Ukraine, he for years worked in the most non-popular field. He helped refugees. And he is anti-militarist. And he devoted his life to fight with discrimination and xenophobia and other kind of hate crimes. And when large-scale invasion started, he joined Ukraine armed forces. And his colleagues, because he also provides journalist work, ask him, but you are anti-militarist. What are you doing? Are you changing your values? He said, no, I'm still anti-militarist. But I have no other instrument how to defend my values. So the time is tragic. And I think that I'm in the right place to be. Maxim Butkevich and his part of his unit was captured by Russians. And they organized a false trial against him because he's rather famous in Ukraine, human rights defenders. And this trial is so badly fabricated that they accused him that he killed people in Severodonetsk on the day when he was in Kyiv. He got a huge term of detention. And for a lot of time, we have no information about him because we don't know from what colony Russia will send Maxim Butkevich. It's a huge country. But we have a news. The news is that and once again, thank you, brave Russian human rights colleagues. The Russian lawyer who protect him in this trial, he visited him in occupied Luhansk Oblast. He is in a colony. He told that, like this, when he was asked, do they torture you and beat you? He answered, not here. Not now, which for us and for his friends means a lot. And yes, we have not just hope. We have to do everything to release Maxim Butkevich and other illegally detained civilians. And there is no recipe. There is no algorithm which we can use, but still there is no excuse for us. Because it's a sad question, let me return to the one story which I told to myself and my colleagues when we are in some emotion, when we lost hope. Because to be during the large-scale war, it's very difficult. And this story was told for me by my friend from occupied city. And she told that in her school, where she was educated, it was a new ritual ingrained, and Ukrainian people have to sing every morning Russian national song. And one child never sing the song. And one teacher asked this child, why are you don't singing? And the child responded, I don't know the words. And the teacher told, go home and learn by heart what the problem. And next day, this teacher asked this child to come in the middle of the class and to start to sing a national Russian song. And this child started to sing Ukrainian national song. And why this story is important for me? Because if children in the occupation continue to resist, we as adults have no excuse to say that we are tired, we lost hope, we lost energy, and to stop fighting.
Thank you.
in the back there, on the very right. Just somebody's just standing in front of you. Yeah.
Sorry. I have a twofold question, if I may.
Just one short one, please, because we only have two more questions.
Okay, sure. So I'll go with the first one. You made mention to the ICC in making a tribunal to hold them accountable as in Russia for their war crimes. My question is, how can we as the West, or democracies, which you cited, realistically hold the strong desire to hold them accountable when we are ourselves as the West, in some instances, lack the strong desire to hold ourselves accountable, as evidenced by items such as the colloquially referred to Hague Invasion Act from the United States of America, which was done in response to the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001?
Sorry, I don't understand the question.
So the United States adopted a piece of legislation which says if ever an American service member is dragged before the entirely illegitimate, horrible work of the devil, International Criminal Court, mm-hmm. we'll invade The Hague and rescue them. Mm-hmm. The so-called Invade the Hague Act to which you refer. But I think the question is more general about sort of double standards. Can we really complain too much about human rights violations, humanitarian violations, if we ourselves don't stand up enough in relation to them? Do you take us serious as fellow human rights defenders, or do you say you have a large English breakfast every day, you watch television, you talk human rights, you do the talk but not the walk, as it were?
Good question, thank you. I am totally confident that if we're fighting for justice, we have to fight for justice globally. Because you can't build paradise. We live in a very interconnected world. And now women in Iran are struggling for their rights. And our destiny as Ukrainian women are dependent on the result of their fight. And I think that we as a people have the responsibility to push our governments to do the right things. And I remember when large-scale war started, the Syrian human rights defender sent me a letter. And like, the large-scale war was disruption for them as well, because it's turned the focus from the situation in Syria, which is horrible. But what they wrote to me, they wrote that we are with you. Your fight is our fight. Please tell us what you need to succeed. We will do our best. And I think this is the right approach, because if we start to blame each other and to compete with each other, they will no sense. We have to unite it and to push not just authoritarian government, but our government in well-developed democracies to be in line with the rule of law. And this is our obligation as a citizens, because we as a citizens who live in free or partially free world have a huge responsibility, because we are minority. The 80% of people live in non-free or partially free societies, which means that we have opportunities to change the situation for better. In authoritarian countries, there can be a lot of population, but a small amount of citizens. What the difference is? Citizen is not just a person with a passport. Citizens is a person with belief that they have responsibility to impact to situation at least at his or her country.
Very good. We're coming to the last question, which is the gentleman in the very last row. I have been asked to announce that once we've heard the last question and answer, and once we have once again given our appreciation to you, if you could please remain seated while the speaker and organizers are leaving the room, and then leave after us. Final question, please.
Thank you for your incredible speech. You spoke
Putin or kind of architects of the war or those who have contributed to this war of aggression. But there are more kind of sharp, direct ways of bringing accountability. For instance, head of Ukrainian intelligence, Mr. Budanov, has spoken about an effort to build up a Mossad-style kind of apparatus for serving justice to those kind of architects of aggression abroad. Could you comment on the legal or political aspects of such a way of serving justice?
I have no information about the vision of Budanov, how he sees this body. But I know for sure what victory means for Ukraine. Victory means not just to repel Russian troops out, to restore international order, and to release people in Crimea, in Luhansk, in Donetsk regions. As I mentioned before several times, victory for Ukraine means to succeed in democratic transition of our country. And this means that we have two tasks in parallel: to help people and to defend them from Russian aggression, and to push our authorities for democratic changes. And it's very difficult to do parallel these both things, because war and democratization, it's opposite directions. War needs centralization. Democratization needs decentralization. War needs limitation of rights and freedom due to security requirements. Democratization means expanded of lives of freedom. So we are in a very challenging situation. We have to find a balance between security and freedom. And this is not an easy task. But we have no other historical time to do it. And that is why we, as a human rights defenders, have to provide a severe oversight very precisely what our government is doing during the war. Because we paid so much high price for freedom. We don't know when the war will end. We don't know whether or not we'll have a better time to provide democratic reforms. So we have to do it now. And I understand this responsibility very clearly while I'm hearing the mother of 19-year student Roman Gurek, who was killed during the Revolution of Dignity by police, intentionally. It was a very difficult story to hear, the mother who lost her child. He started with that when someone bring her son back, she find in her son back the rubbish from Candice, because her son was so polite that he never throw rubbish away, even in this whole mess, which was during this time when police gunning down peaceful protesters. And then she told that, as a mother, I was for sure not happy and don't want my child go to Maidan, because I'm afraid for his life and freedom. But I remember that 10 years before, I myself stand on Maidan on Orange Revolution, and I have no moral rights to stop my son to fight for freedom. Why I tell this story? Just trying with the story to share our understanding of responsibility. We don't want our children to go again to Maidan. We have to complete these historical tasks.
Well, thank you so much for giving the victims a voice.